From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. Casimir Pulaski was born in Poland in 1745. After proving his military mastery in independent struggles across Europe, he moved to Boston in 1777 and formed the colonists' first legion on horseback. He became Brigadier General and saved George Washington's retreating troops at Brandywine. Pulaski was mortally wounded and died in 1779 amid the Siege of Savannah. Earlier this month, the Smithsonian Channel revealed the father of the American cavalry might actually, or biologically, have been a she. That breakthrough came after decades of research by a team based in Georgia with help from colleagues across the U.S., Poland, and Canada. Biological anthropologist Dr. Virginia Hutton Estabrook helped lead the effort. She's professor of anthropology at Georgia Southern University and joins me now from GPB in Savannah. Dr. Estabrook, welcome.
Hello.
And also with us, Dr. Preston Russell, member of the original Pulaski DNA Investigation Committee, and he's also a physician. Dr. Russell, hello.
Hello, how are you?
Very well. And Dr. Stan Deaton is also with us. He's senior historian with the Georgia Historical Society. Hello, Dr. Deaton.
Hello.
I'm going to call you all by your first names, if that's okay.
Please.
All right. So let's see, Virginia, in the documentary on the Smithsonian, we do learn that young Casimir Pulaski was born into a noble family, so his life was well documented. He was christened as a boy, and a doctor did note a debility on his medical chart. Any idea what that was?
It was the priest who baptized him. He had a baptism shortly after he was born at his home versus in the church. And the reason why the sort of immediate short-term baptism happened at his house that the priest wrote in was debilitatis in Latin, you know, translating into debility. That's what we know around why there had to be a fairly quick turnaround with this baptism versus a later date in a church. He actually had a longer form baptism ceremony a bit later, too.
Well, I'm going to speed far ahead and ask Stan, how did he end up in Savannah?
He hooked up with George Washington's army in 1777, as you mentioned. He's known really as the founder of the American cavalry, had been a warrior in Europe in Poland's struggle against Russia, but really had a hard time getting the Americans to understand really the shock value of a cavalry legion. Serve under Washington for a couple of years, and in 1779, Washington sent Pulaski and his legion south, first in the defense of Charleston, but then in the effort by the Allies, the Americans and their French allies, to retake Savannah, which had fallen to the British in December of 1778. So he was in the front line of the effort, literally on the front lines of the effort, in that morning in October of 1779, to retake the city of Savannah. It didn't work. It failed, and Pulaski was killed in that effort. Or died as a result of wounds received in that, anyway.
And that was 1779, right?
That was October 9, 1779.
But for almost 200 years, there was confusion and mystery surrounding his death. What was behind that?
Well, there was some confusion about and conflicting accounts that came out years later about where exactly he had been buried. Had he been buried at sea? Had he been buried at a plantation near Thunderbolt, Greenwich Plantation? What exactly had happened to him? No one really knew. The conflicting accounts were published decades later. In the 1850s, the city of Savannah erected a monument on Monterey Square to Pulaski, and the body at Greenwich Plantation was exhumed and reburied in Savannah, and was just sort of taken as an article of faith that this was the body of Pulaski, although my understanding is that at the time and forever since, there have been naysayers, people who did not believe that that was Pulaski.
So take me back, Preston, if you would, to the 1990s when you were part of the Pulaski DNA Investigation Committee. What prompted that investigation?
The monument to Pulaski, which is now in Monterey Square, was literally falling down. Big hunks were falling, so it was dangerous, and it needed to be taken down to be reconstructed. And in that process, the obelisk was taken off, and at the base there was a wooden box in the middle of it with the name something like General Pulaski or something like that. A wooden box, which was taken over to the Georgia Historical Society and later opened that night. And a team under the county coroner, Dr. Jim Metz, began the investigation of whether this was Pulaski or not.
So the committee exhumed the skeleton, or what remained of it, from that box. What was in it?
All they were portions of long bones and maybe a piece of the skull or something. But it was hardly an intact skeleton. It was mainly fragments of a skeleton, including pelvic bones, in which Dr. Corin Burns, who is an anthropologist, said that, in her opinion, the pelvis looked like that of a female.
So what did the committee take away from an investigation? You did DNA investigations at that time, correct?
Well, they were begun. This thing took at least 10 years, including going over to Poland to try and find descendants of Pulaski, which, by the way, could have only been by way of collateral descendants from his brother, because Pulaski never married and never had children.
But given his position as a Revolutionary War hero, why did the committee reinter the bones and kind of walk away from that investigation?
Well, I guess they thought their job was finished. I don't know if walk away. I don't want to quibble over terms. But anyway, they thought their job was finished, and so his physical remains, bony remains, were reinserted underneath his monument.
Forgive me for interrupting,
please, no,
but
go ahead.
I think at that time the DNA tests were inconclusive.
Right.
Yes. Yeah.
They were unable to extract any workable mitochondrial DNA out of either the bones that came from the Pulaski Monument. Also, they were not able to extract any workable DNA from the bones that came out of Pulaski's sister's granddaughter's grave. So they did locate in Poland this female matriline relative, and they couldn't get a comparative sample out of that either.
So did they conclude that the bones were indeed Pulaski's?
Well, what they concluded, well, first of all, there was some pressure to finish this in 2005 because the renovations on the monument were finished. And because multiple rounds in multiple three different labs of trying to extract DNA from these bones just did not produce any viable results at that time, they had to sort of stop doing this. They'd already put a bunch of money in, and it just seemed impossible at that point.
Virginia Esterbrook, Stan Deaton, and Preston Russell are with me. We're talking about a recent investigation into the remains of the Revolutionary War hero Casimir Pulaski, who died in the Siege of Savannah in 1779. Well, it turns out that DNA and other investigations of his remains say that he might have been a woman or intersex. Well, Virginia, then fast forward 20 years, you became the custodian of these remains. How did that happen?
I got brought into this by my student, by my undergraduate student, Melissa Powell, whose father had been the secretary for the original Pulaski committee. And he was also retiring and had a lot of all the paperwork for this past work. And my student really wanted to continue this work because, as far as the committee was concerned, they had done their best effort to try to identify these skeletal remains. And they'd actually found some features of these remains that were fairly consistent with some things we knew about Pulaski from the historical record, I mean, other than the skeletal sex aspect. So as far as the committee was concerned, there was enough evidence that this could be Pulaski, but there wasn't any way to conclusively disprove that this wasn't Pulaski. Because the easiest explanation for why we see this skeleton with this sort of very female-looking development patterns on it was that this was not actually Pulaski. And so without this confirming DNA, we couldn't actually disprove that it wasn't Pulaski.
So, Virginia, when you finally did look at what was there, these fragments, what did you see that indicated to you who this person was?
The first place you look to look at biological sex from the skeleton is the pelvis, because the pelvis is where you see the most dimorphism happening in the skeleton. So the features of this are individually variable at some level, but the features in this pelvis looked very much on the female, hyper-female end of the spectrum.
So if this had been anybody else's skeleton, would there have been any question at all to you that this was a female?
No. The morphemizations also appear on the skull. Skulls are less specifically indicative as pelvis are for looking at biological sex, but a lot of the features of the skull were also these more feminized, more delicate features that were also consistent with female sex, or at least female skeletal sex. There's a wide range of different systems all coordinating together in the formation of sex, and so there can be differences in developmental patterns, which is something that we're, I think maybe because of this finding, going to be much more aware of than we have been in the past.
So you wanted to make absolutely certain, and you did send the remains off for DNA testing. Now, I wonder why it was easier or you could get a more accurate read than it had been when the DNA tests were made in the 90s. Is it all the technology that had changed?
Yes, it's the technology. It's the kind of primers that are used in DNA extraction. So the lab we sent these out to this time, Lakehead University's Paleo DNA Lab, is a lab that specializes in harder to extract, more degraded skeletal samples. The primers used by Lakehead Paleo DNA Laboratory are able to get much more information out of more degraded skeletal remains than labs that had existed doing this work in the late 90s, early 2000s.
I'm wondering for you what it was like working on this, thinking, you know, wow, this is a major discovery that we are actually confirming now.
I was actually really skeptical that we would be able to get results from especially the monument skeletal remains because they were in such a degraded condition when they came out of the metal box. So part of what I was interested in looking at was, is there any other ways of maybe trying to show intersex or historically trying to disprove these other stories around what happened to Pulaski? And what I found was, at least skeletally, we really don't know what intersex skeletons look like. So there was no way to show some sort of affinity or comparison of these remains with other known intersex individuals. And then there was also really no way to disprove these other stories that Pulaski was buried at sea or Pulaski was buried on an island en route to Charleston without the DNA confirming this.
That's Virginia Hutton Estabrook. Stick around with us. And Preston Russell and Stan Deaton, please stick around. We're talking about the likelihood that Revolutionary War hero and namesake of schools and bridges across the U.S., a fort and a county in Georgia, Casimir Pulaski, was biologically a woman or intersex. We invite your comments, questions, and civil complaints at our Facebook group, GPB Radio On Second Thought. We're on Twitter at OST Talk. You can email us at onsecondthought@gpb.org or leave us a message at 404-500-9457. And we'll be back. I'm Virginia Prescott. Stay with us for more of On Second Thought. We're back with On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. Gender fluidity is a defining concept of contemporary culture, but it was far more rigidly defined when Revolutionary War hero Casimir Pulaski became known as the father of the American cavalry. A new Smithsonian Channel documentary and Georgia Southern University research reveal that General Pulaski may biologically have been a woman or been intersex. Biological anthropologist Virginia Hutton Estabrook was one of the leaders of the team that researched Pulaski's remains. Also speaking with us, historians Preston Russell and Stan Deaton. I want to thank you all for staying with us, and I want to welcome Alice Dreger into the conversation. She's a historian of medicine and bioethicist. Alice, welcome.
Hi, thank you.
Well, Ellis, in the 1990s, the Pulaski DNA Investigation Committee was baffled by a skeleton with injuries and development that matched Pulaski's profile, but whose features were thought to be female, and they thought it cannot be Pulaski. But it was, as we found out, and Pulaski may have been intersex. So if you can summarize for us, I know it's a complicated thing, but what does it mean to be intersex?
Most of us are led to believe that people develop only along one of two pathways, either a standard male pathway or a standard female pathway. But in fact, some of us develop along a different type of pathway. Sex development is actually extremely complicated. It involves chromosomes and genes and hormone receptors and various reproductive parts. And any of those things can develop along a sort of different pathway. So there are many different ways to be intersex, and it's not as uncommon as we've been led to believe.
Estimates of people who are intersex range from 1 in 2,000 to 1 in 100. Why is there such a wide range?
When you want to define intersex, you have to figure out how you're going to define the limits of a standard male or a standard female, because then you have the people who don't fit those definitions. And in fact, nature doesn't present us a simple definition of what counts as standard male or standard female. Humans make that decision.
Well, we do know that Casimir Pulaski was christened in infancy as a boy. So in terms of outward appearance, he had to have appeared more male than female. And is that the right assumption?
No, that's actually not the right assumption. So at his time, if a child was born looking in between, they had to make a decision whether or not to raise the child male or female. But people could bring in alternative reasons for raising a child one way or another. If they were in between, in general at the time, it was more prestigious to have a boy than to have a girl. So it may have been the case that if he was in between, that they decided to go with male because there was more value in a male child in some ways than in the female child. That said, there were other things that would be brought into account. People didn't want a boy, for example, who couldn't pass as a male. And so in some circumstances, those children were raised as girls. But this is not a time when anybody was raised without a category or raised with any kind of third gender category in this particular culture. There are cultures where that happened, but this wasn't one of them.
And times in history when that happened, medical interventions to change or correct, I think is the term they use, someone's sex organs began in the 1920s. Why those changes?
It actually began a little bit earlier. I traced this in my first book with Harvard University Press. The book was Hermaphrodites and the Medical Invention of Sex, and it traced 300 cases of people who were identified as being different from the standard sex type in the late 19th century in France and Britain. So it didn't cover Poland, but I swept in some Polish cases. There was actually a very famous researcher who was Polish from the 19th century, so a lot of his work was very useful. And basically what happened is in the late 19th century, surgery became safer, and that made it more possible to do surgeries that were elective. When that happened, there were some adults who sought some types of surgical changes to their genitals, but that was still pretty uncommon. And it was starting in the late 19th century and then the early 20th century that children with sex anomalies might be taken to a surgeon to be changed. Mm-hmm. But it became very common in the 1950s.
Now, Preston, I know you work with children who had hormonal imbalances in the 60s. When you were training as a doctor at Vanderbilt, what were the kind of attitudes of the medical community towards children born intersex at that time?
Well, at the time, I guess the term is still adrenal genital syndrome, meaning that there is a certain dysfunction in the hormones of the adrenal related to feedback or not blockage, in which an inordinate amount of androids are secreted, and if it's a female, then it will have masculinizing effects on a female.
Alice, what were or what are consequences later in life for people whose parents or doctors make that decision for them that they should have either this kind of surgery or be judged to be one gender or another in that decisive moment?
So gender is not the same as sex, and gender is the way that you feel and the assignment that you're given in terms of your social role, and sex is the way your biology is. Interventions done on children, what we've heard from people who are now old enough to speak for themselves, is that universally, pretty much from the people we've heard from, they wish that they, in fact, could have made decisions for themselves. We've not had people come out and say, I wish my parents had decided for me and they didn't. We had lots of people, thousands of people come out and say, my parents decided for me, and I wish I had had the chance to make the decision for myself.
Yeah. Well, I'm looking at the response to the New York Times reported an article on these new findings about Pulaski, and people raised a lot of questions. You know, how can you tell a delicate face from a skull? Could Pulaski's occupation as a cavalryman have played a part in some of these irregularities? How about concluding this might not be Pulaski? So, Virginia, I'm going to put that question to you. Is there any sliver of a doubt that these remains may not belong to Casimir Pulaski?
There's always a sliver of doubt in science because science kind of relies upon doubt rather than fact. So as far as being a DNA match to the remains that came out of Poland, there were some fairly rare mutations that both of these individuals share that are not shared by anybody else in that genetic data bank of, I think, 22,000 something individuals that they compared this with. So they sort of, to quantify our surety as far as the genetic match, it's 99.98% sure that these are two very closely related individuals that share the same matriline that, you know, are appearing in Savannah, Georgia, and in Poland that match this closely. This happening by any other way than this is actually Casimir Pulaski is incredibly unlikely.
I couldn't help but notice another commenter said, who cares? So another example of the war on men, masculinity, and rationality. Alice Dreger, curious what you say to that.
I agree that it doesn't really matter to me what his biology was. That's not why he was important historically. The reason we pay attention to him historically is because of what he did with his life. So in that sense, I don't really care what his biology had in it in terms of his history. But I do think it's scientifically interesting to think about whether or not this might have been a person who, in fact, was intersex. It's also important to intersex people to know about people who came before them who were historically interesting figures. When I published my first book, I was writing about ordinary people who had ended up in the medical literature. But what I heard over and over again from adults living with intersex was that they felt like I was writing about their own ancestors because they hadn't known that there were people historically like them. I mean, rationally they knew, but they hadn't met any of them in terms of history books. And they found that exciting. So I think that one of the reasons it matters to us is because when you live a life, especially if you've lived a life of hardship, it can be pretty exciting to know there were people like you before.
Alex Dreger, I know you have to go. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Alice Dreger, she's a historian of medicine based in East Lansing, Michigan. I'm going to pick up the conversation here with biological anthropologist Virginia Hutton Estabrook. Also speaking with us, historians Preston Russell and Stan Deaton. So let's go back to what she's saying. Does it matter? Does this discovery about Pulaski's sex change anything about who he was or what he did?
Obviously, it doesn't change the things that make Pulaski interesting as a historical figure, whether you celebrate his achievements, his exploits, his place in history, his role in the American Revolution as a freedom fighter, however you want to say that. I do think it adds a layer of complexity to our study of the past. We tend to, I think that the public in general tends to like these kind of, they don't like complexity in history. And we all know, anybody who studies human beings, past, present, you know that human beings, by definition, are very complex individuals. It's hard enough to understand people who are alive and well today, much less to really get into down in the weeds with people who have been dead for centuries. I think this complicates the narrative, and I think that's a good thing. I think it makes us understand that things may not always be as they seem to us, that there were probably other individuals in history like this that we will never know. As Alice said, who complicate that narrative, I think, and that's always a good thing. It adds a layer of complexity to the past and also makes us think about present day, where people like this fit in the military, in society in general. What do we do with something that doesn't quite fit our idea of a binary definition of male or female? And the conversations we're having right now about the military and who can serve and who can't, I think this adds a layer of complexity to all of that. That, to me, is what makes this so interesting. It doesn't change anything about Pulaski, who identified as being a male, General Pulaski, of the father, as he's been called, of the American cavalry. But it does add a layer of something that wasn't there before. It complicates the narrative.
How about beyond the social and the narrative aspects of this? Virginia, scientifically, does this breakthrough represent, or what does this breakthrough represent for your field and for biological anthropology?
So for the field of bioarchaeology, skeletal biology, looking at human skeletal remains in order to understand people's stories in the past, this is actually really surprising in a lot of ways, partially because the features on the skeleton that look very biologically female look female in these very, very specific directions that if we'd seen the skeleton in any other context, we would have had, you know, sort of no doubts that this was a female and, you know, sort of probably started discussing issues of gender and womanhood in this culture in ways that, you know, we are not discussing now because we know the life of this person. So normally when we get a skeleton, what we know about that skeleton are the clues that we can get from the skeleton itself and not from a historical context of the lived life of a person. So this was this fairly surprising thing. And so we do have gender anomalous burials that we know of in the past, where grave goods that are either men's grave goods or women's grave goods don't match the skeletal sex of the individuals that we're digging up. But generally, we've thought about those individuals in terms of maybe there was a little bit more cultural flexibility in who got to do certain tasks or who got to be a warrior. And we didn't really necessarily think about these in the context that these individuals might have been intersex.
Mm-hmm. Right. And this was almost the epitome of male, embodying the epitome of male symbolism.
Yeah. So, and it's such a unique thing because we know from birth through death about the life of Casimir Pulaski. All of these features that also match up with the life of Casimir Pulaski on the skeleton, we have those as information, but also, you know, these developmental patterns that we would see, because we don't know what any intersex condition looks like skeletally. This has not been something that has really been in the purview of clinicians in describing various intersex conditions. And so we don't have any known skeletons in comparative skeletal collections from intersex condition individuals, at least that we know that they come from one of the intersex conditions. So we just don't know skeletally what any of these conditions looks like, even to be able to compare this skeleton to other individuals.
Well, as we are discovering these new layers of history and have the technology to look at those who lived before us differently, I'm wondering for you, Stan, do you think this will, there might be any plans to update markers with new information, for example, about Casimir Pulaski?
That's an interesting question. And, you know, because he identified as a man and because he's written in all the historical markers as being male, technically, I don't know that any existing markers need to be updated. I think there's probably certainly room one day for a more holistic marker that sort of explains to people 50 years from now who stand in front of the Pulaski Monument in Monterey Square in Savannah who this person was and the layers and the difficulty in identifying. I think that's a story in and of itself. I don't know that the way that Pulaski is talked about in terms of his role in the American Revolution, in the development of cavalry, I think this certainly, again, it adds a layer of interest because in the sense that his contemporaries, my question is, what did they know and mm-hmm. what did they think? Mm-hmm. His comrades in arms who bunked with him, who shared a tent, who shared a meal, what did they know? What did they think? Was he so successful in portraying himself as male that people never had any question about it, or if they did? Again, I think it goes right to the heart. As you said, being in the military in the 18th century, at least, was one of the most defining means of masculinity, if you will. And I think this is, it just raises a lot of interesting questions about what people thought at the time. I know that they thought he was a fierce warrior, a great leader of men. He got frustrated with his inability to for people to understand what the cavalry could be. But I think there's benefit in telling the story of this person as being intersex, without any doubt. Whether that's on a marker, whether it's in textbooks, whether that's in monographs that are yet to be written, whether it's in the story of how this all came about, the different investigations, I think this is an ongoing discussion that we'll have about how do we interpret Casimir Pulaski going forward.
Preston, I wonder what this means to you, so many decades after the DNA Investigation Committee, to see this solved.
Well, it means a lot, and I want to pick up on a theme that Stan Deaton said previously about Pulaski as a genetic female. I'd spent 10 years writing a book on Joan of Arc, and I fell in love with her, and she's been dead since 600 years. But at one time, it was like, well, Joan of Arc was a male. The point being that Joan of Arc lived an unbelievable life in her 19 years, and Pulaski did in his 30-something years. And their accomplishments speak for themselves. And put on a marker what you will, and that might be very interesting, but as far as living a life, no matter whether you're transgendered or male or female, is sort of interesting, but so what?
I think that's a beautiful place to leave it. Thank you so much for your time, all of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, if that does not give you chills, check your pulse, please. Long before Aretha Franklin became known as the Queen of Soul, she was singing gospel in her father's church. Documentary called Amazing Grace reveals the depths of those roots with electrifying clarity. Amazing Grace highlights the recording of her 1972 album of the same name over two nights at a church in South Los Angeles. And that footage has never been released publicly until now. Alan Elliott directed the film, and he's joining us on the line. He's en route to Atlanta. He's going to be at a panel discussion after a screening of the film tonight at Cine Athens. Hello, Alan.
Hi, how are you?
Very well. Very excited to see this film. I have not yet. I'm going to just own that right now. Producer Terrell Whitley is also going to be on the panel tonight in Athens, and he's joining us in the studio. Terrell, so glad you're here on this rainy morning.
Indeed. It's a pleasure to be here with you.
Okay, so I can't resist saying the film once was lost, now it's found.
That's it. That's
so it took 47 years for this concert film to make it to theaters. Alan, why?
That evidently seems to be the timeline. It needed 47 years of post-production, and it was worth it.
Well, that's a record. How did you originally get your hands on the footage? Apparently it was shot in South Central Los Angeles, 1972. The great Sidney Pollack, great director, but apparently didn't do all his homework on this one. You're nodding, Terrell. What happened?
Yeah, well, Alan, how about you tell a little bit more details on...
I thought you were going to take it.
No, I'll let you have it.
He had a bad day. I mean, you know, the best of them have a bad day. And unfortunately, Sidney, you know, for all of the energy and enthusiasm that the cameramen have when they're running around the movie, nobody brought in what you needed in the day, which was a clapper, which was required to sync the audio and the video. So you actually had a visual cue and an audio cue as to where to put film with audio, which in 1972 was a much harder thing to do. There's no cell phones. There's no digital technology. You actually had to, you know, be very conscious of those things. And, you know, bad day for my friend Sidney, but I know he's smiling now.
So you somehow got your hands on this footage. You knew that this had to be a film. How did you manage to make it happen?
Lucky and persistence and vision. I think those are the three things that got us here. I always loved the record. I always knew of the importance of the record. I always found great joy and comfort in the record. And when I found out that there was a film of it, I thought that it would transfer if all the film was there, and we were rewarded when that was the case.
Mm-hmm. Well, I could completely geek out about this. I know this record back, forth, up, down.
Every
single note, and am so excited to hear about it. But I know that Aretha actually did not want, well, let's say she sued for years to stop the film's release. Who wants to pick that up, Alan or Terrell?
Sure, I'll jump in a little bit. Well, there were a couple injunctions, but, you know, first and foremost, Aretha did see the film. And
she did?
Yeah, she's on record. She said she loved the movie. And that's really important to us. We know that she loved the movie. I think there were a lot of things in between there that, you know, we had to go through. She's a perfectionist, and I think... And Aretha handled a lot of her own affairs from a business perspective. And this is one of those scenarios where, you know, she wasn't, you know, astute to the film industry, to the business, but, you know, she had already went off and done a record, a great record. And I mean, for her, it's her greatest selling record in Amazing Grace. And for the industry, it's the highest grossing gospel album of all time.
Mm-hmm.
So on one side, you know, she delivered perfection, if you want to look at it that way. And then when you look at this other side, which is the film, when she stepped back and you look at the film, there are some imperfections. And we know Sydney didn't really, you know, have that level of skill set as a documentary filmmaker. And so when you see the camera swinging and Sydney is actually in the frame and it's out of focus and then in focus. But the great thing is this interesting duality that's created between the imperfection of the film, the perfection of Aretha's voice. And when you bring the two together and you marry it in this special format, I think it creates something super unique. An audience walk away feeling as though they have literally been teleported into 1972. They're part of the experience, and it's hard. It is really, really difficult to escape Aretha's voice. When it comes over, it literally feels like a sonic boom, and it takes you by storm.
It is. It's so great to look at. I've just watched the trailer. You know, this is kind of like industrial green colored walls, and the choir is wearing these silver tunics. It looks like they're intergalactic soldiers in the army of the Lord or something.
Well, you know,
like
when
that.
They march in, it's so interesting. We were in a screening in Nashville, Tennessee. And when that choir marched in, let me tell you something, those people in Nashville lit up and they were like, they're marching in. And it's one of those things that from the Black church is something that historically has been a calling card of what Easter or what a great service means is when the choir walks in. That is an alert. That is literally an alarm bell to let you know service is about to happen.
Mm-hmm.
And so when they march down that aisle and they have on their outfits, I think it is a testament to not only their level of excitement and how prepared and how energetic they're about to be, and the perfection that they have been preferenced by their choir director and the arranger of many of these songs, Alexander Hamilton. It really sets the tone for the evening.
Mm-hmm. So let me just go back for a moment. How did the family actually signed off on this? It was Aretha's niece after she passed. How did they come around and how do they feel about the film now?
So Alan and I were invited to the funeral when Aretha passed, which was a very nice gesture, and we really appreciated it. We had known about her illness kind of late in the process, and at that juncture, Alan and the team, we basically were very respectful, and we pulled back. They asked us to be very, concerned and to pray for Aretha and where she was, and so we were invited. We had been in negotiations with the family and with Aretha for a while, but we kind of pressed pause. And after the funeral, we were invited back to Detroit 6 weeks after the funeral to the Charles H. Wright Museum of African American History to show the film to the family. It was roughly 50 folks that showed up that night. Alan and I had tremendous excitement. We had seen the film. Of course, Alan and I have seen it hundreds, almost thousands of times. Many of them had not seen the film. And when they sat down and watched this film, There wasn't a dry eye in the space. Mm. And after that, Sabrina, as a matter of fact, a few people had to take a walk because they were still grieving. And to see Aretha at the age of 29, at the peak of her power, I know that was a throwback for them in a mighty, mighty way. And afterwards, they pulled us aside and said, hey, guys, we are really, really proud of this, and we want to see this go forward. So we're gonna sign up and join and get on board. And now Sabrina V. Owens is one of our producers on the partner on the project.
Let's just remind everybody a little bit of what we're talking about here. Here's a little bit of Aretha singing "Climbing Higher Mountains" from the film and the record "Amazing Grace." Terrell, Alan, I'm so glad you're here, but I could just keep listening to this. Okay, so the reviews here. Vanity Fair says, forget tissues, bring a towel. Rolling Stone says she never before heard Aretha sing anything like this on record. What do you think she would say now that it's gotten such emphatic reviews?
I think Aretha would be very, very proud. I mean, this week alone, she was awarded a Pulitzer Prize special citation. Her movie comes out in theaters, Amazing Grace. It's Holy Week. Today is Good Friday.
Yeah.
And we're going into Easter. I believe Aretha would feel on a very high right now saying, guys, this is what Amazing Grace is all about. Alan, what do you think?
Alan, you still with us?
Yeah. I'm you know, I think she would be really thrilled that everybody gets it. And that, you know, there is this moment where she's seen as a movie star. I think she really wanted to be a movie star.
Hmm.
And, you know, sometimes over the years, people have asked me, why was she mad at you? And I say, well, she wasn't mad at me. I was 7 years old when they made the movie.
Hmm.
And I have a 7 year old. You can't be mad at somebody like that long. I think she's much more frustrated about the fact that that year Diana Ross got to make Lady Sings the Blues and was nominated for Academy Award. And that, you know, Barbara Streisand got to make The Way We Were the next year. And those divas moved on and got to have that shine. I mean, Aretha sang at the Academy Awards that year, and she wanted to be in that spotlight, and she never really got that shine. And I don't think she ever forgot it. And I don't think she was mad at me or Terrell or anybody else. I think she was just disappointed. So I would hope that she's looking down and saying on an Easter weekend, I told you I could be a movie star.
That is Alan Elliott, director and producer of the film Amazing Grace. Also with us, Terrell Whitley, who is a producer of the film. It is the film or footage of the legendary singer Aretha Franklin recording the album Amazing Grace in a small church in L.A. The film is now in theaters. It's showing tonight in Athens, and they're going to be on a panel to talk about the experience. Well, as you mentioned, Terrell, her best-selling album ever, best-selling gospel album of all time in the genre. So tell us a little bit about this setting over the course of 2 days, South Central L.A. Church in 1972. Why there? James Cleveland, the Reverend James Cleveland.
Oh, yeah. It's such a special moment when you see it. Aretha, as we know, she could have gone anywhere. She could have gone to any studio, any cathedral if she wanted to be at a church. She could have gone anywhere. She had 11 number one hits going into this album. She was the Beyonce of the day. So Aretha, Jerry Wexler, the team there, they made a conscious decision to say, we're going to go into this church in South Central LA, and we're going to lay down this heavy gospel album. We're going to crush it. And it's amazing just the setting, because you know James Cleveland is there, his choir is there, Alexander Hamilton brings this tremendous energy. And then all of a sudden, you know, and it's over two nights. Night one has this great roller coaster ride, and it crescendos with Amazing Grace. But then when you step into night two, something special even happens more. And the great gospel singer Clara Ward,
Clara Ward shows up in the audience.
Yeah, well, she walks down the aisle and in such an amazing glow. And then all of a sudden, they announce her father, Reverend C.L. Franklin. And when he steps in, the twinkle in Aretha's eye is something to be seen. Mm-hmm. It is, you could feel her spirit just lifted. He comes down in the most debonair blue suit and he sits down front. And at that juncture, you knew that night two, something amazing was getting ready to explode. Well, in the back, out of focus at first, there's another guy and he's jamming to the music as she's singing Climbing Higher Mountains, as a matter of fact. And as they zoom in, you see that's Mick Jagger. And Charlie Watts, they now have snuck in. They're label mates of Aretha. They heard about this recording. They sneak in to see a glimpse of Aretha laying down these gospel tracks. And that night, and over these two nights, she's able to lift people in a very special way. This is a racial and multi-generational audience. There's young people, there's older people, there's white, there's black, but everyone is brought together in this spirit of love, joy, and happiness. And Aretha's music and her as a person, she had that power.
Yeah, they're clapping her on, they're propelling her onward, the audience. You can hear that in the record. And also you can hear Reverend C.L. Franklin in the record. You know, he says that, I just remember it so well. He says, "The choir." But talking about Reverend James Cleveland, he used to sing with Aretha when she was a little kid. And Clara Ward, one of her great mentors that really brought the magic. But I'm curious, I mean, so many soul R&B pop singers of that era, definitely at that time, came up through the church. And some crossed over, and some were never forgiven for crossing over, like Sam Cooke, for example. Yeah. So why was, you know, Marvin Gaye, Bobby Womack, all so many singers, why was this Amazing Grace double album her biggest hit? Why was she forgiven?
Alan?
Given is the word. I mean, you know, Aretha's the first generation of, people that had that conversation of soul versus secular. I mean, she actually invented soul, but the idea of crossing over was something that her generation didn't have that Sam Cooke's generation did. You know, she's a little younger than Sam, but Aretha grew up with all the Motown people. You know, she went to high school with Smokey, you know, she went to grammar school, kindergarten with Smokey Robinson. She went to high school with Diana Ross. She grew up in the Motown world, and those people didn't have that conversation about should I be in a church or should I be a pop star. They went where they wanted to go. And Aretha's father, you know, was obviously was a minister and was obviously aware of that conversation. But he personally took her to New York and got her her first record deal when she was 18. And she moved there for 5 years. It was almost her college experience going to Columbia Records. Could have gone to Columbia University, but you know, she made five records at Columbia, and then she graduated, and the next year was the year of respect. And her journey, you know, is the first one in terms of you know, but she's the first on many different levels. She's one of the first women record producers, and you know, Jerry Wexler treated her with that kind of respect that, you know, the Beatles didn't produce their own records. The Rolling Stones didn't produce their own records. She produced her own records. And it's, you know, she is on the forefront of all that kind of stuff.
So. Well, Alan, I'm so happy for you finally getting this film made and out there. And Terrell, thank you so very much for your time today.
Absolutely. Thank you for having us, Virginia. This is wonderful.
Thank you, Virginia. We appreciate you.
Alan Elliott, director and producer of Amazing Grace, Terrell Whitley, producer of Amazing Grace. Their documentary presents the legendary Aretha Franklin. You can find details on their panel and discussion and screening of the film tonight in Cine Athens at gpbnews.org, and watch a trailer as well.